On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
Plenty to come with this morning's show, so we'll start, as always, with our very quick tour of what's making the front pages of the Sunday newspapers. We will start this morning with the Sunday Times. COVID support payouts to roll on until autumn. Stephen O'Brien tells us that the government is expected to maintain the present rates for the pandemic unemployment payment and the employment wage subsidy scheme until at least September, even though the country will gradually begin to reopen from next week. In theory, the pandemic support payments, which range from 203 to 350 euro a week, are guaranteed only until the end of next month. And Michael McGrath and Pascal Donoghue are conducting a review in the context of a 4 billion euro overspend at the Department of Social Protection after the third wave. But allegedly now it would seem from that Sunday Times report that the current rates of payments will continue until the end of the third quarter to try and get everyone in the economy back on their feet. Also on the front page of the Sunday Times this morning, McCann suspects to be charged over the rape of an Irish woman. We're told that the prime suspect in the abduction of Madeleine McCann is set to be charged with raping an Irish holiday rep in Portugal in 2004. Now, this is Christian Bruckner, who is 44 years old. You might have seen some reporting about him, and now he has more latterly become the chief suspect in the abduction of Madeleine McCann back in Praia da Ruja in 2007. He's also been accused of attacking Hazel Behan, who's originally from Dublin and now living in County Westmeath. She has waived her right to anonymity in order to name Bruckner as her alleged attacker. She is now an advocate for sexual advice sufferers. She says she was raped after waking up to find a man standing over her bed, dressed in tights and a leotard and armed with a 12-inch machete. She identified Bruckner after he was sentenced to 7 years in Hanover in 2019 for raping another 72-year-old American in Praia da Ruja in 2005. So maybe the thing's beginning to come together a little bit there. Allegedly he is to be charged now over that. Also on the front page of the Sunday Times, and we will be talking more about this with our newspaper panel a little bit later this hour, a majority of Green Party members in Dublin Bay South are backing Claire Byrne, a councillor in the party's by-election candidate, in preference to Hazel Chew, the Lord Mayor. Byrne phoned Chew yesterday morning to confirm her intention to seek the nomination to contest the by-election, which has to be held sometime before November. Byrne is a close ally of Eamon Ryan, who's the Green Party leader, and has worked in his constituency office for most of the past decade. So if there was a microcosm for the Green Party's national divide, it could be coming to a head very shortly at a convention in Dublin Bay South. On the front page of the Business Post this morning, new vaccine deals to deliver 20 million doses by the end of 2023. The state is set to announce two new deals with Pfizer and Novavax for millions of additional vaccines. The move comes just as IBM and Salesforce have been hired to develop a passport app that could facilitate easier access to international travel and greater privileges for those who have been vaccinated. This is all part of a new deal between the European Commission and Pfizer-BioNTech for up to 1.8 billion vaccines out to 2023. That would mean that Ireland would be able to avail of almost 20 million additional doses. It's the world's largest single vaccine deal to date, and it also means that obviously if there needs to be some sort of booster shots or annual top-ups, that Ireland will not be found wanting when it comes to supply. Also on the front page of the Business Post, quite an interesting story done by Aaron Rogan, who tells us that staff at Paddy Power have described a gambling addict who was using stolen money to fund his habit as a wild man before giving him cash bonuses and tickets to high-profile sports events to keep him betting with the company. This has all come out as part of a High Court case in London. It's found that the man was attracted to Paddy Power, given a £20,000 signing-on bonus, and there were no responsible gambling checks. This was despite a staff member referring to him as wild because he had bet £548,000 sterling in just one day. And anyone who's read the book Tony Ten about the treatment of high profile gambling addicts, that will probably chime a little bit with them. The front page of the Mail on Sunday this morning, restaurants plan to sue government. The Irish Mail on Sunday has learned that the government is facing an embarrassing legal challenge over its plans to confine the reopening of restaurants in June to hotels and only and outdoor establishments with outdoor facilities. Local authorities, meanwhile, across the country are scrambling to cater for the onslaught of the surge outdoors. Meanwhile, some ministers and rural TDs have also hit out at Neffert's reluctance to reopen pubs, accusing them of having an anti-alcohol ethos. We might get to that when we have Philip Nolan, the head of the mathematical modelling team, with us a little bit later. And finally for now, and I've deliberately left this one to last because it will give me a nice little tee up to our introductory to our paper panel this morning. The front page of the Sunday Independent. Two-thirds of people, north and south, fear the prospect of a united Ireland could risk peace and lead to a return of violence in Northern Ireland. This is according to a new Sunday Independent Kantar opinion poll. The island-wide poll also finds that cross-border rejection at only a 50% plus one majority might be needed to carry a referendum on a united Ireland and for the result to be accepted. 81% of people in the Republic and 74% of people in the North either believe that a two-thirds or three-quarters majority should be needed in order for a border poll result to be accepted. Well, to discuss that, we're joined now on the line by Kevin Doyle, who's the Group Head of News at Independent News and Media, and also by Elaine Loughlin, who's Deputy Political Editor at the Irish Examiner. Good morning to you both. Kevin, I'll come to you first of all. I suppose a lot of us might have thought that there would be a cohort in Northern Ireland who wouldn't be best pleased at the outcome of any border poll if it meant unity, but I suppose this does show that a lot of people don't think that any transition will be smooth at all.
No, I think, Gavin, going through, that there's a lot of different questions asked within this poll and a lot of different kind of angles looked at it. And I think what stands out for me is, in terms of, if we take the Republic first, where there was 1,500 people polled, so quite a big sample size, there is definitely a big support there and a big momentum even towards the idea of a united Ireland. But then when you start to actually drill down into questions about how that might work, as in how would you pay for it? What about the symbolism? What about our cultural identity? What about our political system? There's an awful lot less certainty around those questions and around what that would look like. And then, as you might imagine, in the north, the thing that stands out for me there is that you have the two polarized sides in terms of nationalist and unionist, and they make up pretty much a reasonably even split, or it's moving towards a 50-50 split. But then there is this third cohort now, which is almost equal in number to those other two, and that is the kind of the floating voter, the undecideds, the people who really don't pin their colours to the mast, if you like, and seem to be, it's no longer that it's just split along those two lines. You now have this third cohort who seem like they'll probably listen to the debate when it takes place and make up their minds based on what they believe would be best for the decades to come. So I think it's interesting in that it just, what it shows when you put it all together is that actually we haven't really had a very substantial debate around United Ireland, how it would work, what it would look like. And I suppose we all know the damage something like that can do in the wake of the Brexit referendum.
Elaine Loughlin, good morning to you, Deputy Political Editor of the Irish Examiner. What do you make of all of this? Because I keep coming away with the idea, similar to Kevin, that a lot of people like the notion of a united Ireland in theory, but then when it comes to the nuts and bolts of how you make it work and what life looks like afterwards, people aren't really quite so wild.
Yes, exactly. And it's quite some time. It's 5 years ago now since Enda Kenny, then Taoiseach, said that the EU needs to prepare for a united Ireland. And I think during that same summer of 2016, Leo Varadkar said that he believes that he would see a border poll or a united Ireland in his lifetime. And here we are kind of still talking in vague terms, in the ideological basis of United Ireland rather than the nuts and bolts. But what I picked out from, and Kevin is right, there's a substantial amount of information in this poll in the Sunday Independent today. What I picked out from it was the size of the majority that people think would be required. Now, we know that the Good Friday Agreement just stipulates that it has to be 50% plus one to get across the line. But the vast majority of people, when you tally up those who think that it should be over two-thirds and those who believe that it should be even greater, over 70%, it's 81% of people in the south and 74% in Northern Ireland. And we saw what happened with the Brexit poll when there was a very, very tight margin of error there, or the very tight conclusion in that referendum, and we now have a split in Northern Ireland, we have a split in Scotland, and then obviously in other areas, particularly in England, where people were in favour of Brexit, there's a variance in opinions. And I think there is the fear there now that similar could happen if we had that very tight margin and if such a referendum was passed by perhaps 51, 52, or even in the low 60s. I'm not sure that would be a legitimate conclusion for many people based on this poll anyway.
Yeah, but, and what I find particularly striking about that, Elaine, is that when you look at the split between voters north and south about whether 50% plus one would be good enough, in the north it's kind of perhaps understandably 31% think it's good enough, but 46 don't, and I think they probably accept that you'd be sitting on the doorstep of a very large disenfranchised minority who might be inclined then to make life difficult for everyone else. What I'm surprised by is that it's such a fine margin in the south, that 38% of people in the south think that the barest of majorities is enough, and that 37% of people think it isn't, so that maybe people in the south maybe not quite as sensitized to the problems of having a very, very large defeated minority taking part in a state they don't want to be in.
And it's interesting as well, it's higher amongst the 18 to 24 year olds, those who really don't have a lived experience, thankfully, of a Northern Ireland in conflict or the Troubles, so perhaps older people, and we do know that it's, you know, the over 65s are less inclined to believe that the 50% plus one would be enough, because they have a lived experience of the Troubles and of the conflict and the devastation caused on both sides of the border, and of course in the UK as well during that period. But you are right, and Colin McCarthy has an interesting piece again in the Sunday Independent commenting on this and maybe looking towards the financial impact that a United Ireland would have, certainly down here. And he looks to Germany and the reunification of Germany 30 years ago, where West Germany at the time was asked to pay a solidarity tax of 7.5%, and that came on top of personal tax and some business taxes, and that was to make up for this gap in the budget in the East. Now, again, people asked here, 22% of people willing to pay more taxes to see a United Ireland. So there's difficulties there when you get down to talking about this and talking about the nuts and bolts. And I'm even thinking about the NHS is a massive issue that would come up. Who pays for it? Do we have an NHS style health system across both sides of the island, or do we go towards the system that's down here? I don't think that would be acceptable for people in Northern Ireland given what they have now. But Colin McCarthy again, he suggests that the gap currently is 10 billion per year. Now that may change based on when a United Ireland would be formed and when a border poll would happen.
Yeah, well, you'd imagine if there was to be any kind of negotiated or orderly transition, that the British government might well finding itself agreeing to pay the pensions of former civil servants, because it wouldn't make any sense for an Irish state to be paying the pensions of army veterans or for people who didn't serve that country itself. So it wouldn't necessarily turn out to be 10 billion in the heel of the reel, perhaps.
It may not be, but even if it, he's suggesting that even if it was only half of that or a percentage of that, we'd still have to increase taxes here. He's suggesting perhaps USC would have to be doubled, or income tax might have to go from 20 to 28%. So, yes, you're right, Gavin, there would be a deal to be had with the UK in any sort of negotiations or any sort of United Ireland, but they wouldn't be picking up the entire bill, and some of it would have to be footed by the Irish state.
Yeah, that there's also, I suppose, the question, Kevin, that we might have to take on some of the UK's national debt if we're taking over some of the territory that was previously belonging to the UK. One thing that I was really tickled by, though, Kevin, and I'm sort of interested to get your thoughts on this, is that there seemed to be this incredible appetite on both sides of the border for there to be a poll either now or sometime in the next 5 years, including in the north, where there's still a reasonable chunk of the population and a reasonable majority who are opposed to unity. And I don't quite know why people in the north would so want a border poll if they're so opposed to unity, unless they thought it was just going to put the question to bed forever.
Well, I think that's it, Gavin. Obviously, the questioning couldn't go on further and dig into individual views of why exactly people wanted a border poll at a specific time. But I think there's two interesting points on that exact piece of polling. And one is that it kind of shoots the argument of both the British and the Irish governments about the timing of a border poll, because we know Boris Johnson very recently said that he thinks it's a very, very long way away. The Secretary of State, who will ultimately be the person that decides that a border poll will be called, has absolutely no criteria set out for when that would be, or what kind of a backdrop would be needed. So we just rely on the Good Friday version, which is that he or she has to believe that a poll might pass. Mm. But obviously, when you actually see the Northern Ireland figures, I don't think there is any sense that a border poll would pass in Northern Ireland. So to be honest, the only conclusion you can reach, and obviously the Sinn Féin argument is that we need a border poll yesterday, is that some perhaps on the nationalist Republican side just want it to happen come hell or high water. And maybe it is the case that some of a unionist slash loyalist persuasion believe that it will be better to have it now when we have all these outstanding questions and people will start to look at the money and there won't be any answers around the money or the symbolism issues or the political issues. And so maybe if you just do it now, that'll be it. And it'll be over, maybe put away for another decade back in its box, if you like. That's the only conclusion you can kind of, the only logic you can reach on that. But of course, we know from Scotland that that's not necessarily the case, because as soon as the Scottish referendum fell, they were immediately back talking about when the next one would be. So there is also an argument that that could happen.
And we could be talking about that another week's time as well, depending on the outcome of the Scottish elections this coming week as well. Well, on that, actually, the idea of how a border poll would go north of the border, I thought it was fascinating. And again, it's in the corner of page 22 of today's Sunday Independent. There seems to be a more concentrated disagreement among unionists, among people who are perceived as British or among people who are Protestant. They are more opposed to unity than nationalists or Irish or Catholic are in favour of it. So maybe there's also a case that the nationalist population are not quite as committed about the merits despite their sort of political ideals. Elaine, of course, all of this is coming with one eye on the centenary of partition, which is tomorrow. It was the 3rd of May 1921 that the 32 counties were split into 26 and 6. And of course, this also coming at a time where there's now going to be a vacancy in the job of First Minister. Edwin Poots this morning appears to be suggesting that he might not necessarily like to be First Minister. He's told one of the papers in the North that even if he is the DUP leader, that he might not choose to lead the government. It would be a little bit like Mary Lou McDonald or Gerry Adams being the leader of Sinn Féin, but not actually the Deputy First Minister in the North. How do you see the DUP vacancy influencing things in the short term and longer in Northern Ireland?
Yeah, certainly. And I think it's an interesting departure to have both a leader in the Assembly and then a separate DUP leader. And it might actually be very convenient for the DUP, because we do know that the hardliners who were not happy with Arlene Foster and some of the measures that she was in favour of, essentially, in the Assembly, they wanted her out and have been successful in that now. So it might be convenient to have someone like Edwin Poots as leader of the DUP, who would be able to articulate these strong hardline views, and then have someone who was able to work with the likes of Sinn Féin in the Assembly to get things done, essentially, and would be a compromise candidate or a compromise leader within the Assembly. So it might actually work out well for them in that sense. But it's certainly an interesting contest.
Kevin, I need to get to an ad break, but before I do that, I've seen it written in some places today that Arlene Foster is complaining that the party that she now apparently appears intends to leave, she's not even going to be a backbench member of the DUP, she wants to leave altogether. She says that it's not the party that she joined back in 1998-1999. One would have thought that the party that it's becoming is closer to what it was in 1998, because it appears to be moving towards a much more hardline position on constitutional issues, on social issues, which I would have thought is much closer to where it was when Arlene Foster got on board in the first place.
Yeah, I think the pendulum is swinging back, Gavin, is probably the answer to that. You're right. Like, it's not the Northern Ireland that existed back in the late 90s, even in the early noughties either. It's a very different country than it was back then. The DUP, I think, came along that road a little bit of the way. And now it seems that apart from tearing each other apart, it seems that those on that harder right wing are going to win out in this particular instance. So it's not the party that Arlene Foster joined, but it's probably moving back towards it. I think maybe Arlene Foster has moved a little bit more towards the centre of politics. It'll be interesting to see what she does next, because obviously we know that Peter Robinson, after he actually stood down, has made a lot of interesting comments about a United Ireland, about the future. It'll be interesting to see if Arlene Foster has the same, dare I say it, evolution after she leaves politics.
Yeah, but it's interesting to see how she kind of stands as an untethered bystander, whether she might be a little bit more off the cuff as regards some of her remarks. We'll see how all of that rolls out in the weeks to come. An awful lot in today's Sunday Independent about that cross-border poll, a big spread between pages 21 and 25 of today's Sunday Independent. It might be a long road to unity, hopefully not quite such a long road to freedom, because now we have a plan to relax COVID restrictions.
In fairness now, Tony Holohan was quite frank. He wanted it. He wanted to get the message to Donegal. He's concerned. His team are concerned. I'm concerned as somebody who lives in the Milford area. My kids go to school in this area. I'm concerned for Letterkenny with the high levels.
Fine Gael TD Joe McHugh speaking to Susan Keogh on News Talk Breakfast earlier about last night's meeting between Donegal TDs with the Minister for Health and the Chief and Deputy Chief Medical Officers. You'll be able to listen to, back to that if you like on newstalk.com. Still joined by Kevin Doyle and Elaine Locken going through this morning's papers. And Kevin, it's interesting that there still is a little bit of focus, including on your own front page this morning, about Donegal and whether people in Donegal might feel really unfairly slighted by some of the comments of Tony Holohan this week.
Yeah, it was quite interesting to hear. I think we've had at this stage Joe McHugh there, Piers Doherty was out. I think Charlie McConlogue also raised it in that meeting with the health officials yesterday.
Paddy McLaughlin also made the same argument this morning on News Talk Breakfast as well, so it seems pretty universal.
Yeah, and I suppose, look, it's obvious, isn't it, that the local TD has to stand up for their constituents and kind of push back against the rhetoric. But I think what Tony Holohan said, it's something I've heard myself speaking to people with connections in Donegal in recent weeks, not just in the last few days, but that there was this sense up there that maybe things weren't being taken as seriously. And I know that's a real lumping everybody in the same pot. But the figures do show that there is a problem in Donegal. And I suppose there's two ways Tony Holohan could have come at it. And I suppose one was to grab headlines. And let's be honest, you know, Neffet and Ronan Glynn, I think it was said, Neffet don't want to be on the front page of newspapers. But when they do want to be there, they are well able to come up with the quotable lines that will get them there. So I think when Tony Holohan started talking about the dogs in the street, knowing what's going on in Donegal, that's exactly what he was playing at.
How come the likes of Donegal get singled out? Donegal, which, by the way, is on the doorstep of other counties which have much more opportunity for social mingling because the North is so far ahead in vaccinations than we are. But also Donegal being singled out now when Dublin itself and other counties in Leinster have been top of the charts and way outperforming the national average for COVID cases for weeks, if not months now, and nobody singles out them for special treatment.
Well, that's arguably true, I suppose, Gavin. I suppose the Donegal factor, there does seem to be an issue there with Derry and movement between the two areas. I think Derry, I'm not sure what the figures are in Derry right now, but at one stage recently, they were quite ahead of the Northern Ireland average. So there does seem to be an issue there. I suppose it's hard to get into the Dublin v Donegal debate, isn't it? You have over a million people in Dublin and Donegal is more dispersed. You would expect that Donegal would have less risk, given the way people live, that there is less apartment living, there is less cramped conditions and those kind of mitigating factors there. So you would imagine that. But I suppose the risk for Donegal now is, and this is what hasn't really been said publicly, but has been, I think, slightly hinted at, is that what happened to Kildare, Laois and Offaly last summer could happen to Donegal. And that hasn't really been said out loud, but I think that threat is kind of hanging in the background, that if the figures don't come down quite quickly, they could be out on their own when the rest of us are allowed to start moving.
A bit of a nonsense though, wouldn't it, if they were next door to Derry and Derry had more freedoms than the Republic and then the rest of the Republic was getting by with more freedoms and yet Donegal was still left behind, that we already have a kind of a two-tier Ireland, we would have a three-tier Ireland then. That would seem really unfair.
It would, let's be honest about it. And I think there would be a revolt against it, to be honest, because I remember when Laois, Offaly and Kildare were put on lockdown last summer, there was huge pushback there. And we remember the publicans and restaurants at the time were outraged that was happening. And the claims were that, well, people were just leaving the towns like Tullamore and wherever and going over to Athlone in Westmeath because they could go there for whatever they might need. So it does create all that. And of course, Donegal, huge tourism. And obviously with everybody likely to be going on staycations this year, there's a big economic opportunity and a big economic need for Donegal. So perhaps this is a case of trying to scare the bejesus out of people before it's too late, and that it does end up in that scenario where they have to look at Donegal as an isolated case.
Of course, there is loads written in today's papers about the broader reopening of society following on from the COVID plan that was published on last Thursday. But Lane, there was a particular piece in the Business Post that you jumped out of today.
Yes, and it's looking forward to the next few years, really. They're mentioning that there's a deal being done at EU level to deliver 20 million doses by the end of 2023. And while we're all focusing now on getting our first vaccine and our second vaccine, it looks like we could be getting a third, fourth, fifth vaccine, perhaps. And this could become similar to the flu jab that you get on a yearly basis. You'd also be getting a COVID jab. And I think Leo Varadkar indicated that earlier on in the week when he said that this pandemic is going to hang around for a long time, even when people are vaccinated and the country perhaps is more or less up and running again, that there will be parts of the world where COVID still exists and still is really a plague, and that we'll have to be careful for the years to come. And certainly this EU deal that looks likely to be done now is pointing towards that. But just to go back as well to the Donegal issue, sure. Because I think while you can say Derry has a lot of freedoms, and the North indeed has a significantly more freedoms now. We've seen the pictures of beer gardens and people queuing for pennies and the likes. The vaccination programme is just flying ahead up there, and that is the reason why people in Donegal, while they may only be a couple of kilometres away from their counterparts in Derry, there's a massive difference there when we are talking about the vaccination programme, even if we're going ahead now. And I know the numbers each week are massively, massively increasing. I don't want to use that word ramping up, or that awful term ramping up, but that's what it is, really.
You've done it now, Elaine.
Ramping up is this year's wet pubs. It's a phrase nobody likes and everyone has to use.
Yeah, and the Sunday Business Post as well had interesting details. They're saying 240,000 people due to be vaccinated this week, and that figure will be doubled to around 500,000 by June. But they do have an unnamed source saying that right now the HSE vaccination clinics aren't capable of doing the numbers that they think they can, which is the first time, I suppose, that I've certainly seen doubt cast over the ability to vaccinate people, because right up until now there's been difficulties with delivery. There's been the absolute saga with AstraZeneca, and I know there's been a redrafting. I think we're on our 27th draft of the rollout plan now. But once the vaccines enter the country, they are put into arms very quickly afterwards, and there hasn't been any problem to date with that. And we haven't used the community pharmacies yet either. They're willing to get involved the minute they're called to do so.
A lot of that, I think, was premised on the idea of having Johnson & Johnson available for everyone to use, and not just the over 50, so that might compromise that just a little bit. Just while we've been on air this morning, the figures for Friday's vaccinations have been published. Almost 45,000 vaccines issued on Friday, 33,000 first doses, nearly 12,000 second doses. It means that for the 7 days up till Friday, there was a total of nearly 213,000 doses administered. So it really is taking flight, but it will need to get a little bit higher than that again if we're to meet the targets before the end of June. Kevin, there's obviously an awful lot written in today's papers about the COVID plan. Anything that jumps out for you?
Well, I suppose we have to start looking at people going back to work and what happens next, and the idea that at some point we're going to have to pay for all of this disruption and the fact that our lives have been on hold for so long. So I suppose the front of the Sunday Times does make reference to the idea that the PUP payment may be extended into September, which I think, to be honest, it seems a little bit obvious, and it's going to be a huge challenge for the government, though. And I know the ministers are meeting this week, Heather Humphreys in the Department of Social Protection and the finance ministers, Michael McGrath and Pascal Donoghue, and probably Leo Varadkar as the enterprise minister as well, to try and come up with a way to start tapering off the payments and to start pulling back from the, I mean, it was 120 million in the last week alone, and we're doing that week in, week out. So they really, I know there's a debate, I think, is it the Mail has the story of the restaurants planning to sue the government because they're not allowed to open at the same time. But I think the government, when you look at the finances of it, would love nothing more than to get everything open, because it is costing them and ultimately us an absolute fortune. And there is going to be a huge economic challenge now for how they wean people off those payments. And let's be honest, the live register figures at the end of this are going to be substantially higher than they were when we started out last February of last year, before this took over our lives. So the economics of all this, is going to come into sharp focus in the week ahead.
Elaine, any thoughts on that? Or is there anything else in the papers that you want to have a look at?
Yes, well, I can't leave the COVID discussion pass without mentioning Liam Collins's article at page 5 of the Sunday Independent. He mentions, and he's among a growing mass now of people who, you know, are mothers, fathers, grandparents, siblings who are getting vaccinated. And he said after his vaccination, the most common question asked was, "What did you get?" And he said it reminded him of standing at J.J. Harlow's pub in the square in Roscommon in the 1980s when those campaigns between Haughey and Fitzgerald were in full flight, and he was with two other journalists at the time, was asked what the three journalists were asked what they'd like to drink. They named three different drinks and three Powers whiskies were just plonked down in front of them. And he said it was the owner's pub and we'd have what he decided. And it's a similar case with the vaccine now, but he's delighted to get it. He mentioned that he'd ingest arsenic if he thought it would lead to a more normal life. Yeah. I wouldn't be going that
wouldn't
far.
Wouldn't be advisable, no.
Thankfully, people are very on board with the vaccination programme and we have seen a large uptake. And there is that positivity around. You see more and more people getting vaccinated and being able to maybe meet with others who are vaccinated too. And I know that was increased as well by the Taoiseach and his announcement this week. So a lot of positivity around, thankfully.
The idea of getting indoor powers, by the way, it might still be July away. So although it is good to have a little bit of a taster of what might be to come, it is going to be a little while. And even outdoor pints, when you think about Derry versus Donegal, it'll still be 6 weeks, I think, before we have outdoor beer gardens opened in this part of the world. Kevin, finally, any other thoughts on COVID coverage before we go to a break?
Well, I just think that it's very true what Elaine says there. There is, you hear it all the time now, don't you? Which one did you get? And I think as we go on and we get into the stage where we get down into the younger cohorts, it will be interesting to see what happens with AstraZeneca and Johnson. Will they change those again? But the other point I'd pick up on just, Gavin, and it's not really mentioned in the paper, but it is kind of hovering in the background, and the idea of the how this is all measured by the HSE and will they be capable of dealing with those big numbers? I have my doubts, and I think we will end up in a situation where we don't really know who's vaccinated and who's not vaccinated, because it's the take up seems good, but we actually don't have any idea of the people who are turning down vaccine opportunities or the people who aren't applying on the portal system. And I do wonder where we end up at the end of this when we start talking about herd immunity and we start talking about digital passes. And for example, I know someone in my own life who's been offered 4 vaccines at this stage. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to take one of them for myself.
Could they borrow them and bring them home, please? Yeah,
that's a bit of that. But that's how disconnected I think the system is. And I think that may become maybe a problem that we're willing to push down the road now so we can keep the rollout going. But I do think at the end of this, it's going to be very hard to assess, does Gavin Riley have a vaccine and does Kevin Doyle not? I think we'll just all have to take a lot of personal responsibility on the system.
I will happily throw you under a bus if it means that I get my vaccine before you do. I have no problem saying it on air right now. Andrew Madden's been on touch on Twitter. He says on the question of a border poll maybe needing to pass with a higher percentage, he wonders, would we apply the same rule to all future EU-related referenda in this country? Will we just rerun everything if we don't like the result? Which is a fair question. And Danielle wonders, given the growing non-aligned movement in Northern Ireland, it's weird that the polls never seem to ask about Northern Irish independence. There's a thought.
I believe that if we have a calm, reasoned debate over a period of time leading into unity referendum, you know, I believe and I have confidence in our people that we can get to whatever that outcome is on peaceful grounds.
Sinn Féin's Padraig McLaughlin, TD for Donegal, speaking on News Talk Breakfast this morning about his approach to a unity referendum, not believing that it might be a fait accompli, that it could be rejected by people north of the border. On that topic, Dan is in touch on Twitter. He says that the Indo poll today appears to be predicated on a leading question that a united Ireland would see a rise in tax. I think, in fairness, Kevin, wasn't it the case that the wording of that question didn't imply that a tax increase was a prerequisite? It was merely asking people, would they pay higher taxes or would they be prepared to pay higher taxes if it helped to unify?
Yeah, there's quite a lot of social media chatter, and I think it's coming obviously from one particular camp trying to dismiss that question around whether or not people would be willing, which was the question, to pay more tax to facilitate it. I think it's a fairly reasonable question. We've already talked about the fact that there's a subvention from Britain of 10 billion or more. And I think, let's be honest, there are those who make the economic argument, and maybe it's true, that a United Ireland would bring us extra wealth and that there would be extra investment and employment there would improve. But it's not going to happen overnight. And so I think it's a valid question to ask, would you be willing to pay extra tax? It's not saying it's going to happen. Maybe we'll find another way. Maybe America will help. Maybe the EU will help. And as you had pointed out already, Gavin, the UK will have to stump up something. But I don't think it's an unreasonable question to see would people be willing or not, because that has to be part of the debate. And if we can prove it, there's an economic way that avoids all that and that there is some other way of funding it, then super, that let that be part of the debate. But let's have that debate.
Yeah, but maybe just for full disclosure, that it wasn't predicated on the idea that you had to pay more taxes. It was just asking people whether they would be willing to do so. We will move on to the other topic that I said we wanted to talk about, which is the Dublin Bay South by-election, which of course predictably has an awful lot of coverage in today's papers, but with them of course all being the D4 media and that being their home constituency, of course. Before we get to what's in today's papers though, Elaine, I'm interested in your thoughts on the position taken by Owen Murphy, the outgoing TD, who appeared to just decide that, you know, maybe it wouldn't be fair for him to continue to draw a salary if his heart wasn't really in the job. You could argue that, well, you know, wasn't he given a mandate to serve the full term, and that really it's a bit outrageous if he thought his mind could be changed in having any interest in being a TD. Why did he bother running at all a year ago?
Mm-hmm. And it is only a year ago since he did run, but he said after his decision, or after he resigned as a TD, that he had thought about it over the past few months, certainly since the new year, and he said it wouldn't be fair on his own constituency and members of his own constituency, the public, to remain in place for perhaps another 4 years when his heart really wasn't in it, but he was taking a public salary, and he said it was quite a nice salary as well, but I'm sure that probably wasn't really helpful to the likes of Kate O'Connell, who was his constituency, well, some would say his constituency rival, but ran
colleague
on
notionally
the same,
at least anyway.
Yes, exactly, ran in the same Fine Gael ticket as him, but didn't retain her seat in that constituency last year. So there's for and against it. I think really it was perhaps used as another excuse when really he just wanted to get out of politics. He has been in politics for 12 years, and he said he'd done his time. He's a young man. He wants to move on to a career in international affairs now at this stage. Again, he said he hadn't been job hunting before this, that he was going to leave. So he hasn't. It's not like the likes of, let's say, Michael Darcy, who left the Shannon to take up a position more or less straight away, that he'll just begin his job hunt now. But that was his multiple reasons for leaving, I suppose. But the fact that he really didn't seem happy in the backbenches, and that was quite obvious for anyone looking in at Leinster House. While he did contribute to COVID discussions and got involved in maybe rebuilding the party after last year's general election, his heart really wasn't in it, and you can see when a TD is just going through the motions, and I think Owen Murphy would agree that that's what he has been doing for the last few months, certainly.
Yeah, I think we would all agree that we don't want anyone in Leinster House who's only going through the motions. Either you want to be committed to the job or you don't do it at all, which is why the vacancy arises. And Kevin, as I said, lots written in today's papers speculating about who might be filling the void or whose it is to lose. Anything that jumps out for you in the papers?
Well, Shane Ross's piece is quite hilarious in his way. He dissects each of the candidates in, I suppose, a way that only Shane Ross can. Cutting through, I suppose, the number of barristers that are in this race, which is quite extraordinary. And I say in this race because obviously they won't all end up on the ticket, but you have Ivana Bacic, the Labour potential. You have James Gagan, the Fine Gael potential. Both of the Fianna Fáil potential candidates, Claire O'Connor and Deirdre Conroy, barristers. Hazel Chu, the potential Green barrister. So you're seeing a trend here, and a number of the men have gone to Gonzaga, which Shane Ross is comparing to the old boy of is becoming the old boy of Eton, Eton College, which of course a lot of the conservative bigwigs have gone to. He's kind of saying that is the new thing there. So it is a fascinating one. I know people were saying, why is one constituency, just because it's in Dublin 4, getting so much attention? It's not where it is, it's who is involved in this race. They are almost all household names, people that you will recognize from being in the papers or on television reasonably regularly. And that's why it's interesting. And then the extra, of course, interest is the shootouts that are going to take place in the parties, particularly the Greens and Fine Gael. And they've already started. I mean, you have James Gagan in a couple of the papers today, pictured with his kids and his wife, and, you know, surrounded by daffodils and flowers, and it's all very lovely. And then you have, of course, Claire Byrne, who works
in Eamon Ryan's office.
That Claire Byrne, a different Claire Byrne, the Green Party councillor, who works in Eamon Ryan's office, having declared yesterday, we're still waiting to hear from Hazel Chu. And then Kate O'Connell, we're still waiting to hear from. It's really the personalities.
A few of the papers today have already said that although she hasn't publicly declared, that Hazel Chu has called various other people within the party, including Eamon Ryan, to indicate that she does intend to contest it. So at least there will be a convention there. Elaine, might it be useful in some ways for the Greens to have, you know, this kind of face-off where it has to be the Eamon Ryan wing of the party manifested in Claire Byrne versus the Hazel Chu wing of the party, and maybe just kind of decide who's going to be in charge once and for all, and then if there's defections after that, then much as it will weaken the party, that maybe it's good to kind of finally have these whole things resolved?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting you used the future tense there, Gavin. Might it be interesting that they would have this face-off? I think that they've already had this face-off multiple times since entering government, even more recently with the Shannon by-elections. And we know that Hazel Chu ran against party leadership as an independent in that, and was backed by a number of TDs and senators, Green Party TDs and senators. So we've had that face-off multiple times, and as well we had it over the likes of the Climate Action Bill and other measures that government are working on. Exactly, yeah, CETA, and CETA has yet to really come to a conclusion, shall we say. But just to go back to the constituency itself, and I know sometimes by-elections really don't get national attention because they're a local election, essentially. We're only looking at one area in a particular part of the country. But as constituencies go, I think if you were asked, or if you were to ask any political anorak, political journalist, or even a politician, if we were to have a by-election, where would you like to see it? I think this constituency would be it. It has everything. And I know my colleague Alison O'Connor, when she was asked for her initial reaction to the resignation of Owen Murphy, she said she was delighted. Now, it was looking towards the by-election that will come.
Yeah, maybe she'd run out of box sets, so she needed something new to watch.
Exactly. And I think this is going to give us certainly political drama. It'll be gold. We had it in the past, you know, we had the rumble in Ranelagh between John Gormley and Michael McDougall in this constituency. But away from the drama, and there will be drama even between it within the parties that has already been spoken about who gets on the party ticket. But one interesting thing is we could see a ballot poll or a ballot ticket that is completely female, because we have two candidates from Fianna Fáil, both female. We've two candidates at the moment in the Green Party, both female. So we know that a female will be put forward by both of those parties. Likely to see Kate O'Connell put her name forward for Fine Gael, although we know we have James Gagan in the running. Exactly. We have Ivana Bacic already declared as well.
There's Bridget Purcell of People Before Profit. There's Norma Burke, the independent. I think there might be Manix Flynn, I think, the incumbent councillor. But yeah, it would be predominantly, if not nearly universally, female.
Yeah, which is, you know, when we're talking about gender quotas and representation in the Dáil of women, it has to be seen as a positive that we might have, if not all, certainly the majority of names on that ballot paper being female. So there's a good chance that it may be a female that gets in eventually.
In a constituency which up until now was entirely represented by men. Kevin, just to put a cap on this, and also to make it a little bit more relevant for listeners who are outside the particular parish that we're all in this morning. This it will be interesting on a national basis, because this is the first election that there's been anywhere in the Republic since COVID hit. So then it really could be framed as a referendum on how the government's doing.
It could, but if you break that down, I'm not sure that will play out entirely, Gavin, because it's probably one of a handful of constituencies where, based on the opinion polls, Sinn Féin wouldn't walk a by-election. You know, we haven't really mentioned Sinn Féin in all of that. There's talk of Lynn Boylan being parachuted in. I actually don't see that happening because I don't think Sinn Féin would want to damage her for a potential run somewhere else by putting her in a constituency she can't win. So you have that, but that does make it important for Fine Gael. I know you have Jim O'Callaghan coming up after a break. He has to put in a good show here because he wants to be the future leader of Fianna Fáil. So that's the challenge for him. But I don't think there's any real chance of Fianna Fáil taking this seat. So it's a really strange constituency because it will come down to Fine Gael possibly versus the Greens if they put forward Hazel Chew. And that in itself is fascinating, the idea that you have two members of the coalition having the biggest fight out here. But let's see what happens, Gavin. One other thread I think that's kind of mentioned in a couple of articles
briefly
in the papers today is just that the government might call this early, that they might not wait till October, November to have this, that they would try to do it the summer because obviously with the COVID restrictions lifted, we don't know where we'll be later in the year. But also there will be a feel-good factor off the lifting of COVID restrictions, and that might be the better time to offer people the opportunity. So that'll be interesting to see as well.
It's like the old idea of waiting for Ireland to win a Six Nations and then calling it immediately after that when everyone thinks the country's going really well. We'll wait and see when it happens. In the meantime, Kevin Doyle of Independent Newspapers and Elaine Loughlin of the Irish Examiner, thank you both very much for joining us.